everyone, and welcome to The Commentator's Curse. My name's Ian Danter. This is the show where we kind of lift the lid on the weird world that us commentators inhabit. I've been working as a football commentator on radio for local and national stations for over 20 years now, and every press box I go into, I encounter the great and the good of this industry who've had very different routes to me to get to where they are. And that's what this podcast is all about, just talking about the journeys that these people have been on and the wonderful moments that lead to their advancement and things like that. There's a whole archive of episodes that you can dip into, which started with Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker back on episode one. So where you found this podcast, you'll find all the rest and you can listen at leisure, because they're intended to be kind of timeless and not particularly of the moment. Anyway, let me introduce my two guests for this week's podcast. And it's really nice that I've thrown these two chaps together, because the Venn diagram of me and these two gents does connect in a musical way, which we'll get into. But also, anything that we don't cover during the course of the next hour, you'll be able to pick up in these two gentlemen's fine autobiographies. My first guest, for example, released an autobiography entitled Grape Face for Radio, which detailed his time not just covering football, but also Olympic Games and dodging all sorts of strange shenanigans going on at the Atlanta Olympics. And he was front and center at a time in the 90s when that battle for the hearts and minds of listeners went on between independent local radio and BBC radio for football rights. It's John Anderson who's with us on the Commentator's Curse. Ando, how you doing?
Very well, thanks, Dan. It's lovely to be here.
Good man. And alongside John is a man that John knows well, and vice versa. He was the BBC's chief football correspondent for many years, covered the best part of 30 FA Cup finals, countless World Cups. And my only regret in my broadcasting career is I only got to work with him at the one tournament alongside him at Brazil 2014, which ended up being his last tournament before he retired. A voice of total authority. It's great to have him on the show. Mike Ingham is with us on The Commentator's Curse. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Ian. Hello, John.
Now, I must straight away say that the great thing about the three of us is that we do all have a music obsession just as much as a football obsession, which not all commentators have. But I know that this leads you to, before we start talking about your past and your beginnings, this has led you two guys on a sort of crusade, wherever you have ended up at major tournaments, to find the nearest Backstreet record shop to go delving for vinyl. I can think of you two taking a trip to, was it Krakow or Warsaw? Yeah. In Euro 2012 to try and find some rare artifacts in a record shop.
The thing about some of those trips that we did, John and I, very often to the Eastern European countries, was that the games would be played very late in the day, very late kickoffs. And so we'd be hanging around with not a lot to occupy our minds. So John and I would go off in search of these places. I mean, my favourite one of all, I know John will remember the trip to Poland, but probably my favourite one of all was when we went to Moscow. And the Russian team, they call themselves something else. Was it the CIS or something they were playing? Anyway,
doesn't Commonwealth of Independent States.
That's right, yeah. But I found this place, and I ended up buying Russian versions, I mean, completely in Russian, of albums by Led Zeppelin, Creedence Clearwater, The Doors, all these people, The Beatles, wonderfully produced things. Anyway, in the end, I had about three holdalls of these albums. I remember getting to the airport to come back. And in those days, we used to fly with the team. And I remember Nigel Clough just looking at me for about 3 or 4 minutes thinking, what on earth are you doing? I think he thought I got a kind of corpse or something in taking back with me, and in fact I ended up giving a lot of them away, but I still got them here and they've got pride of place on the shelf.
You got me a copy of the White Album by the Beatles, the Russian version, which I've treasured. The other trip I remember, Mike, was probably the last one we both went on, which was the Euros in 2012, and we found a record shop in Krakow that Dance mentioned. And do you remember the owner? He was so kind of obsessed with the pristine condition of his records that he wouldn't let us touch them. Do you remember? And he said, you can't, you can tell me what you roughly like and then I'll try and find it. And we said, well, that's not the point of record browsing, is it? That's the whole idea is to sort of find stuff yourself. But he got terribly funny about it. But in the end, we talked him round. But they were good times, weren't they? I mean, we used to talk about music as much as we did about football.
Oh, we did.
Really. Yeah.
Well, I remember going and finding this place in, I think it might have been Belarus, I can't remember. And I was with John Curtis, dear John Curtis, who was also into his music. And I found these CDs that just seemed to be too good to be true. They were only about a quid each, you know. Yeah. And they were double albums, and it was the best of George Harrison. I mean, the thing is, it's sort of great stuff to have on in the car, you know.
Yeah.
Things you just can't... But I had this horrible feeling that when we brought them home, it would be the best of Mrs. Mills, you know. And it would, they just put the sleeve in there just to con everybody. But they were authentic.
That sounds great, that Krakow Records. That sounds like Spinal Tap. Don't even look at it, you know.
It was, yeah. No, literally was. He was this sort of old hippie guy. And yeah. He was just a really odd character. It was down some windy street. It was in the middle of nowhere, wasn't it? You had to spend ages trying to find it. I mean, I remember buying a few things in the end. But Mike, it was you mainly, because you're more into vinyl, I'm more into CDs. But I remember you sort of saying, well, you know, I'm going to have to touch this vinyl in order to, and in the end, he relented.
I thought we're going to have a problem here. We're going to get thrown out, which is counterproductive. So what I did, I remember, I tried to think of the most obscure album that I could immediately recall. I think it was a Harry Lukowski Stringsville or something. And he obviously seemed to be impressed by that, John, didn't he? Because he allowed us to then look at his cherished goods.
That's a good gateway into it. What this does prove, and what I want to bring this back to, is it shows what you and John, Mike, found a way to kill the time. Because going away on tour, either for a European jaunt for a European club side or for England, can be mind-numbingly tedious, and you have to fill the hours with stuff, don't you? Otherwise, you're just going to go scatty.
Yeah, I mean, the classic one, which Mike and I again were involved in, was in Euro 2004, where you're right. I mean, you know, there is a lot of time to fill, and I think it was, bless him, the late Lance Hardy, who very sadly died this year. It was his idea that we had a dinner where we'd all nominate our top 50 albums, and we'd go round in a row, and we'd discuss it all. And there was people like Henry Winter, I'm trying to remember who else was there. Sean Custis was there, and there were various. But Steve,
well, there was somebody else who was there who should remain nameless, because when we came to actually then totting up the votes to see what the best album was, we had to almost discount the one person there that went for Shawadi Wadi. Do you remember?
No, that's right. Yes, I do. Yeah. That didn't go down well at all, did it? But what then happened, we then had another, because it was so much fun, we then had, we did singles, we did our favourite singles.
Right.
And I can vividly remember, I mean, because I knew you perhaps a little better music-wise than some of the other guys, and you were the first person to nominate your number 50, and it was a song that I'm sure Dance enjoys enormously. It was Enter Sandman by Metallica.
Right.
And you could see people going, good God, Mike Ingham. Metallica, really? And it was, but I thought, oh, that's a great choice, you know. That was. But the other funny story about that was there was various people who were working for the travel company at the time. There was a few young women who were working there, and one of them came down all dressed up and said, is this the singles night?
Well, I tell you what, I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard Enter Sandman, but I still think it's probably, along with a couple of others, just about the greatest intro to a rock track that I've ever heard, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that's the thing that I've missed most of all, both of you, since I finished. I missed the football, but I missed the camaraderie as well, you know. I missed the crack, if you like, being with those, with everyone. And well, what was a wonderful thing about it right from my early days was that... when I was, you know, Brian Butler and I were the kind of the only radio people around before, I'm talking about pre-John now, you know, and yet the newspaper guys, right from the start, big name newspaper journalists, took us on board and embraced our company and everything else, you know. Mm. We had some great times.
Yeah, we did.
It's funny, Enter Sandman's kind of used as an intro track by many a European football club as their intro, and Thunderstruck by AC/DC, another one. And in this country, rock music just does not permeate that sort of... clubs entering the field of play thing, does it? But you go around Europe, you know, Dortmund and Leipzig, AC/DC and Metallica are everywhere.
Yeah, I mean,
Derby County came out to the Dan Busters March in the 50s and 60s.
Watford still come out to Zed cars, which is something that virtually nobody could possibly remember, you know. But I mean, there is a few exceptions. I mean, George Sefton, the guy up at Anfield, he plays some good records, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
He focuses on Liverpool bands. So I remember going to Anfield and hearing things like the Lars and Echo and the Bunnymen and Teardrop Explodes, because he was a great champion of that.
Yeah, somebody used to come out to, I can't remember where it was now, but somebody used to come out to Waterfront by the Simple Minds, which was great as well.
Oh,
that, yeah,
yeah,
do you remember?
Yeah, I don't know who.
That wasn't, no, it might be the Scottish side, wouldn't it? Just because of the Simple Minds connection, I don't know.
Well, there's, but, Jim Kerr's a big Celtic fan, isn't he? Huge.
Yeah,
I don't think it is Celtic, but he's massive Celtic, isn't he?
Oh, Alan Brazil mentions it quite often. sort of crowbars it in.
Yeah.
Whatever Simple Minds, because he went to school with him, of course, didn't he?
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, they That's went to the same school when they were growing up. So him and
I'd have to say Jim Kerr looks considerably younger than Alan Brazil.
Let's go back to beginnings, if you will, because that's kind of what I like to do with this podcast and find out the routes that people took. I'll start with you, Mike, if you don't mind, because I know you went to university and studied law. Was a media or a broadcasting career in your thoughts from a very early age, or did it come along by accident?
I probably wanted to be a drummer, Ian, actually, thinking about it, because we had this little band at school called Tea Leaf Tex, and the Memphis City All-Stars or something, I can't remember. Anyway,
same thing I had for bands when I was a kid, like Minotaur. It's a bit more esoteric that you've got there than I.
Well, no, I suppose subconsciously I wanted to go into that world because radio was just omnipresent in my life, you know, from a tiny tot. We always had the radio on in the house. There wasn't any football on television, and talk about the 50s, really. So you gravitated towards radio for music and for sport and for football. And I was never going to be a lawyer, really. It was a good thing to do for 3 years, simply because it was something different from school. It was a new discipline, which was good for me. And but I was the only one, I think, on my course that then didn't become either a barrister or a solicitor. I just used to, you know, they'd be sitting around in coffee breaks reading the legal journals, and I'd be reading Charles Bucket's Football Monthly, you know, the New Music Express, something like that. And I was lucky to be in Birmingham, because that was really, I didn't really know, I had no idea how I would try and get into the media, because, you know, in those days there weren't media courses you could go on at university or anything like that. You were very much kind of self-taught. And I was just in Birmingham. I was a DJ at a nightclub for a year, which was great, because it was the first time I ever spoke into a microphone. And then with the time I had off during the daytime, I was watching the cricket at Edgbaston, and they put over this a public address appeal for people to help with the hospital radio commentaries. And I answered it, and I ended up doing some cricket commentary. And funnily enough, I think my first football commentary ever was at St Andrews. I think it was Birmingham and Newcastle in a League Cup game in 1973. So having got that little tiny bit of experience, I was then able to start applying to local radio stations.
So who was that commentary for? That was for hospital radio, was it? That Birmingham?
I'd say to anybody now, how do I get started? When people say to me, well, how do you get into the business? I can't really answer that, because it's all sliding doors and it's all fortune and everything else. And I became a commentator in the end by accident, really. But it was for hospital radio in Birmingham. They had a studio at Edgbaston. They were based at Edgbaston. So a guy called David Wigley used to run the show, and
he's a friend of my dad.
He wrote to me and offered me this cricket commentary. And then when I did the football, there were a couple of games I did. Apart from the Birmingham game, and I think Gordon Taylor was playing for Birmingham in those days. And I did a game at Villa when Bruce Rioch was still there. But you know what? I can remember doing it, and I think I probably tried to describe every single player. It was a complete mess, a real jumble. No, you know, well, the one thing I kind of eventually learned from people like Peter Jones was just to sit back a bit, you know, and take in the full picture rather than trying trying to commentate on tennis, you know, trying to commentate on every stroke. And it just ends up being a jumble.
But you had very few frames of reference in terms of, you know, what you could draw upon for radio commentary experience, because, you know, in the early 70s, people were still finding their feet as to how the craft worked.
No, that's true. And I just went in with my enthusiasm, really, and that was all it was. And also, I suppose at the same time, there isn't great pressure on you because they're just really, the Birmingham Hospital Radio Network were just grateful to have volunteers, basically. They didn't expect any sort of Raymond Glendening style standards or anything like that, you know. I'd hate to listen back to, I mean, those tapes hopefully been long wiped, you know. But that was in 73, but I didn't actually get to do any commentary. I didn't do any commentary at all in local radio. And they were the best days of my life, by the way, local radio. I didn't do any commentary at all until over a decade later.
We'll get to that as we move on. My mind is blown that you knew David Wigley, who was one of my dad's closest friends growing up, who was a Villa fan and used to enjoy coming around to my house and taunting me about Villa's apparent power over Birmingham City at the time. That's extraordinary. And for you, it was insurance in the early days, wasn't it?
I mean, Mike said it's sliding doors. I mean, you know, I had absolutely no ambition whatsoever to do anything at all, really, when I left school with desperately awful A-level results and no hope of going to university. So, I mean, first thing I did was sign on the dole. And because, you know, I wanted to go out drinking and go to gigs and buy records and go to football, obviously I had to earn some money, so I just drifted into this insurance. That was a pensions administration clerk. And basically what happened is one of these things that at the time it was awful, but when you look back, it's the best thing that ever happened to you. I had a relationship breakup with a girl who I'd been going out with for quite a while. And I just not quite woke up one morning, but thought, I'm sick of this. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm fed up. I've got to try and do something. And just by chance, a friend of mine found an advert in the Surrey Advertiser. I was living in Guildford at the time. And it was for a radio journalism course that had just started in Highbury College down in Portsmouth, postgraduate. So I applied. I mean, I didn't have a degree, but I think it was fairly chaotic, the whole course. They were desperate to get people on it. So I sort of got into it. I spent a year down there. I failed the course, but fortuitously, I did an attachment at County Sound, which was my hometown station in Guildford. And I was enormously fortunate to come under the auspices of Nick Collins, who everybody knows as the doyen of England Sky coverage, Sky News. He was editor at the time. And, you know, I mentioned that I like football. So, you know, I was working for £8 a week helping out on the breakfast show while still sort of working at the insurance company. So it was quite a long day. But at the weekend, he gave me a chance to cover a football match. It was Farnborough Town against Fleet in the Surrey Senior Cup. It would have been 1984. And I did it from the tea room on a telephone looking through a window. And, you know, from there, I then thought, well, I can do this. And I love doing this. It's great. And applied to various stations, and Signal Radio in Stoke-on-Trent picked me up, and I got a job there as the sports editor. Had an absolutely brilliant time. They loved it, did my first ever commentary. It was Stoke against Coventry in the FA Cup fifth round, the year that Coventry went on to win the cup. I think Mickey Ginn got the winning goal. I remember that. And you know, as a result of that, I then ended up in national broadcasting with Independent Radio News.
So you got a job as editor?
I did, yeah. I still to this day am not sure why, because I was staggeringly inexperienced. I couldn't even drive at the time. I had to buy a moped. And, you know, it is bizarre, but Chris Moore, who was the news editor there, for some reason had faith in me. It was difficult, to be honest. I mean, you know, I was from Guildford, which is a white-collar, middle-class, suburban commuter town. And suddenly, you know, I'd never been to Stoke-on-Trent in my life, which was a year after the miners' strike and all that. And, you know, it's a potteries town, as everyone knows. It's extraordinarily working class. So it was quite hard. And I think there were people at the station who probably didn't think I was up to it. And, I, you know, if I'm honest, I probably wasn't sure I was myself. It was quite a step. But in the end, I met people like Rob Beasley, who Mike will know, former ended up as the Sun journalist, and a lad. To go back to the music thing, when I turned up at Signal Radio first day, I met this skinny lad who was the YTS trainee, and his name was George Fajestica, and I'm still in touch with him. I spoke to him yesterday on the phone. He did rather well too. He's currently the guitar player in Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. So, and me and him used to raid the record library for all the chuck outs, you know, in those days.
Oh,
We
yeah.
talk about Mike coming back with his suitcases full of records from Russia. Every day I'd come back from Signal with something under my arm, you know, it would be something like REM or something like that, you know.
You're dead right. You'd go into BR&B, the place afterwards, was of course a hit station. It was a pop music station. They'd forever get, you know, press releases of CDs. And of course, nobody else in the building was remotely interested in the rock music. And of course, these things like Pantera CDs, and, you know, went straight into this massive tub. And you would fish through there once a week, and invariably you'd come out with something. Oh, that's fantastic. I would have paid 15 quid for that.
And the other thing that used to happen is that we'd cover Stoke City on a Saturday, and the skipper in those days was George Berry. You remember him from The Wolf with the famous afro. Lovely, lovely man. Great bloke. After he'd done all his stuff at Stoke, he'd come into Signal and he'd be rooting through for all the reggae releases, which again were things that, you know, the normal MOR stuff that they played on that radio station. I mean, everything, you know, I you know, so many bands I discovered literally by going, oh, this isn't band with a weird name. I mean, for you it's metal, for me it was post-punk, you know. Things like the Birmingham bands like the Mighty Lemon Drops, do you remember them? And Mighty and those kind of bands, you know.
The thing is, it was the golden age of record reps, the '70s, when I was on local radio, and I can remember being given complimentary copies by some of the reps, and if it said demonstration sample not for sale, I gave it away because I didn't think it was going to be of any use, you know. And those records now are worth kind of 100 times more than you know. And they used to bring these bands in for you to interview. And we were on like a, I was at in Derby, which was made for local radio, Derby. But there was like a little triangle of Derby, Nottingham, Leicester. So these bands would do the three interviews. I'd always get them after they'd been to see Trevor Dan in Nottingham. So they're usually not in a very good mood, you know, when they arrived. Because he used to put them through it a bit. But anyway, but sometimes we used to do record reps a favour, you know, just to get a few albums. There was a guy called, I know he did some football reporting, but he might be a little bit older. There was a guy called Frank Pritchard. Do you know Frank Pritchard?
Yes, I do. Well, Coventry, very good.
Yeah, and he used to be the record rep in the Midlands for A&M. And he rang up my mate Stuart White, who was fellow broadcaster at Radio Derby, who went on to become, by the way, the longest serving regional television presenter in history for the BBC in Norwich. He rang up Stuart to say, look, Stuart, I know, look, can you just do me a favour? I've got these three guys. They got an album out, and I need you to do an interview with them, you see. And so Stuart said, yeah, it's fine. Okay. I haven't got a studio, though, so we'll have to go into this little area new studio, they called it, which was a bit like the TARDIS, you know, a little tiny little post box, sitting there with these three other guys cramped round this table. Anyway, to cut a long story short, it was the three members of police who came in, you know, and they're promoting their debut album. And that's how it was in local radio in those days, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I used to do occasional, like, what would happen, they'd do a sort of round table program on a, I think it was a Thursday night or something, and occasionally somebody would pull out, so they'd drag me in, and it was fantastic. I remember doing one with Frank Sidebottom, guy, you remember him, sadly, he died, Chris Seavey, he had to take his head off because the headphones wouldn't fit over it, but he insisted on wearing the swimming pegs.
Oh, but he sounded like this,
and he was great, and I also remember doing one with the two women out of the Human League. Suzanne Sully and Joe Catherall? We ended up talking about Sheffield Wednesday. They were big Wednesday fans. You know, those sort of, there's magic, as you say, local radio in the 70s, probably for you more, in the 80s for me. It was just such a laugh. And, you know, you could absolutely indulge in our twin passions, football and music.
But I find that musicians are desperate to talk about football more than they are about the album that they're about to release. You know, you chat with Joe Elliott from Def Leppard, all he wants to talk about is Sheffield United.
Yeah, well, I remember when I finally went down to Radio 2 on the eve of the Cup final in 1983, they sent me along to this media day with Rod Stewart and he was promoting, was it Atlantic Crossing? I can't remember anyway, it doesn't matter. And there were thousands of people there, including, you know, radio stations from America and what have you. And the guy, Bernard Doherty, the press officer there, said, no, I don't think he'll want to talk to you about football. He's got, you know, other interviews to do. And I literally just doorstepped him after about 7 hours when he walked through from one room to the next, you know, and I said, Rod, any chance of talking about the cup final? And he came straight over, you know, wanted to talk about football. He said, oh, God, anything to get away from all this music stuff, you know. Most of the people came to us, but I remember going to the Albany Hotel in Birmingham once, and this was slightly ironic because I interviewed Roger Daltrey, after he produced his first solo album, and my microphone was broken, and Roger Daltrey spent half an hour mending the microphone. Now this was a guy who used to throw microphones around on stage.
He used to have a gaffer tape round his microphone. So that when he did his twirly thing,
And he was getting all, so he got all these matches out of a matchbox, and he was fiddling about and everything else, and it literally took about half an hour, and then then it got mended, and he did a nice little interview.
To be honest, if you're in the Who for any amount of time, mending things was probably quite a big part of your life. It was Moon's drum kit smashed to pieces, Townsend whacking his Gibson into a speaker stack. I think.
I know that you've said to me that some students listen to this, Ian, and I would say to anyone really. If you can get into local radio, then do it, because it's a wonderful foundation. You get to make mistakes, you know, you get to do everything, basically. You get to do every single aspect of the job. I mean, I started just reclaiming tape. That was my job for about 6 months, just making sure you could use the tape again, you know, for use. And
you mean like wiping stuff that was on a reel-to-reel so that
what they used to do, this is quite technical and boring, but they used to put what they used to call yellow leaders and red leaders in tape. In other words, that's when the thing ended. It was like banded tape. And I just used to have to take all these yellow leaders and red leaders. Otherwise, it'd be dead air for about 10 seconds, you reuse the tape.
Right.
It was a really important job. I mean, the whole radio station would have fallen to pieces if I hadn't been doing that. But then again, of course, you know, mentioning the music, but also mentioning the sport. I mean, if there was one place to be in the 70s, it was Derby, because Derby were champions in 72 and 75, you know, they're in the European Cup and everything else. And so consequently, I was always having a dialogue with the sports people in London.
And how was your relationship with, I mean, Brian Clough was there for a time, of course. How did you have many dealings with Brian at the time on a one-to-one basis?
Well, I was lucky in that the three managers that I really dealt with were all in demand media-wise, you know, that was Cloughy and then Dave Mackay and then even more so Tommy Docherty. My main thing with Cloughy was he'd left Derby, but he was in Nottingham, obviously. But I used to have to go across to see him quite a lot, because every year there was a Derby County player, one of his Derby County players, having a testimonial. And so I'd go over, you know, and I get a letter from the City Ground saying, can you be there at 10 o'clock in the morning? So you get there at 10 o'clock in the morning, you'd finally see him about 6:30 in the evening, you know. But it was worth it, because you knew that when he did come through, you know, he'd be gold dust.
Yeah.
I have millions of stories about Clough. I don't know what to say, really. And when I left Derby, he was very generous towards me and recorded a little message to say to my dad, you know, if he could ever be of help in the future, just pick up a phone. And in fact, I left it for about 2 or 3 years before I tested that. And then when I did, he was there for me. You know?
Cloughy had this, I've said this before, that Brian Clough had this way of making lots of people think that they were the closest to him as a journalist, but he had this very, very clever way of choosing who to give exclusives to keep people.
You never knew from one day to the next if you were going to, how he was going to react to you, basically, you know, and which was good. He kept you on your toes the whole. He was the most difficult person. No, difficult's not the right word. Most challenging person I ever had to interview, simply because, you know, you just put one word, because he thought he could do your job better than you anyway. That was the thing. And to such an extent that a friend of mine, Mike Carey, there was a paper in Derby, and Clough was signed up as the big signing, you know, to do a football piece at column every week. But Mike Carey wrote it for him. He was the ghostwriter. Mm. And I always remember him going along at the end of the week, 1 week, to see him in Nottingham. And Cloughy sort of looked up from the table, you know, and said, "Morning, Michael." You know, he said to him, "I've got your headline this week. This is what I want you to write. I want you to write in the first paragraph, what a week it's been for saying bugger me."
Oh, God. I don't know. Who's been your most challenging interview, Ando? Because, I mean, you know...
I was lucky enough, actually. I did come in contact with Brian Clough. He was notoriously reticent in doing post-match interviews. Brian Clough once called me young man. which was a huge thrill for me, and then saying no to an interview. But I was quite proud that, I mean, it's the only time I've really been proud for failing to get an interview. I've had a few run-ins. Sir Alex Ferguson was often quite difficult, particularly when things weren't going well. I mean, he was hard. Funnily enough, the other person I initially had a run-in with was Mike and I's dear mutual and much missed friend Graham Taylor, when he was at it was Villa, wasn't it? The season that Liverpool won it in 1990. I think Villa pushed them all the way, didn't they? Yeah. Under Graham, and we did a game. I think it was at Coventry, and Villa got beaten, and we had a little pool of people, you know, taking it in turns to ask the question. I'm sure your old mate Tom Ross was one of them. And to be fair, they were asking the usual, a lot of it was very sort of local based, but I wanted a more sort of national angle for what I was doing. So I said at the end, finally, Graham, a lot of people will say that Aston Villa's title hopes are over. What would you say to that? And he just said, and walked off. And I thought, oh God, that's a bit weird. And then he appeared on a television programme, I think it was at Granada with Clive Tilsley, where he actually said something along the lines of, well, I thought the reporter was rather rude. He shoved the microphone in my face and asked me a question. I didn't know him particularly well at the time. But I then wrote to him, and said, well, that wasn't my intention, Graham. I hope. And he was lovely. He wrote a fantastic letter. And it became known as Graham Taylor's eight-letter response, the word box.
Yes.
And at the end of the letter, he put, I could have responded to your question with a five-letter response, but as usual, I tend to go on a bit. And from then on, I'm a Watford fan, so he's an absolute total hero to me. Lovely man. I'm sure you remember, Mike, Graham's 60th. We were in Vienna, I think, weren't we, doing an England game? And you very kindly invited me to a dinner that we had with Graham to celebrate his 60th birthday. My favourite Graham Taylor story was when we had got to know each other and he was in his third spell at Watford and things were not going well. We were down in League One and I did a piece with him. And at the end of it off, Mike, he said, oh, do you get to come down to the Vic very often these days? And I said, well, I don't, to be honest, because I'm working and I don't cover League One football. And I said, to be honest, they never win when I come. And he turned around and he said, they never bloody win when I come either. That summed him up. Brilliant self-deprecating humour.
And of course, Mike, you worked with Graham as much as anybody did in a press box once his managerial career was over. And he always struck me as, and the self-deprecating thing seemed to come across just as much as anything else in the times that he worked with you.
Well, we used to have lots of flights together, lots of journeys together, just the two of us talking, lots of meals together. And the one thing that would always struck, by the way, I think about him almost every day. I was really, really shocked when he left us. And the thing about Graham was that, because I had two relationships with him. I had the relationship, like John, I had the relationship with him when he was the manager of a club side, but then more importantly, the manager of England. And then obviously I had the relationship with him as a colleague and as a friend. And he never, ever really recovered from his England experience. He masked it well, and it must have been tough at times because he was constantly in the company of media, not necessarily the individuals that gave him a hard time when he was the England manager, but nevertheless, symbolic gentlemen, if you like, symbolic members of the media. But he never, ever overtly made that obvious that he was still going through pain. But there was hardly, I can never remember really a journey with him where at some point the subject of England didn't come up because he was still deeply tarnished and by it all. And I guess I didn't really appreciate what he went through and what he was still going through emotionally until one day when we were in Minsk in Belarus, and Graham always used to like to, wherever we were, you always just try and go and find out a bit more about the place. Because as we were saying earlier, these were very long days. Games were kicked off late at night. And he decided to go to this museum in the middle of Minsk and in this grandiose building. And it was basically a museum. It was a memorial to all of the patriots, all of the citizens of Belarus who perished during the Second World War, during the Nazi atrocities and everything else. Many of them died. I mean, thousands of them died in the concentration camps. So there was this memorial, and I think he went with Mark Pugach, and so he was taking it all in, very somber, looking at all the displays. And then halfway through his tour, some England fans came in, you know, and recognized him and made their way towards him. And he always used to go through the same routine, really, when England fans approached him on these trips. He'd put out his hand and say, "All right, boys, you know, all right, fellas," trying to be friendly. And one of them stepped forward and said, "It's Graham Taylor, isn't it?" And Graham said, "Yes, yes, it is. Yeah, yeah." He said, "Oh, I'm really pleased to meet you, because I've been longing to meet you for a long time." Well, Graham said, "Oh, yeah, yeah." He said, "Yeah, I've been longing to tell you for a very long time. You're a wank." And the thing that was most horrifying about that was the setting, really. The fact that it was in this place, which was this war memorial, basically, to all these poor souls who'd perished in the Second World War. And yet, it came down to that banality, you know, and that's what he had to endure.
You've got to choose your moment, haven't you? For goodness sake. Yeah, mind you, that's cool. That you shouldn't have to say that anyway, regardless of the location. My Graham Taylor story is basically about my impression of him, which got me in trouble, because, I've become known in the Midlands press pack for doing a Graham Taylor impression. Because of The Impossible Job, me and my best friend, Keith Laurent, we worshipped that documentary. We learnt it like Spinal Tap. We learnt every word of that documentary. And it got to the point where I was doing an England under 21 game at Molineux, and Janine Self, Neil Moxley, Dave Harrison, Darren Fletcher was there for Five Live. A lot of the guys that we know, John Curtis was there, JC, you mentioned earlier, Mike. And I think it was... Neil Moxley said, "Could you record a Graham Taylor voicemail message for my phone for when people ring up?" I said, "All right, well, what do you want me to say?" "Well, just wing it like you normally do." So I recorded some. This is in the press room at Molineux, you all know, two floors up with the curly chips just behind us and whatnot. So I did this. And so what you have done is you've come through to Neil Moxley, but what you must do, don't hang up. No, don't! Hello, that sort of thing. So I did this for Neil. He got a round of applause. Dave Harrison asked me to do the same thing. So I did two or three. Unbeknownst to me, a week later, I'm at Villa Park to do a game. And Dave Harrison from the News of the World walks up to me and says, "You're in trouble." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Do you know who called me 2 days after you left that message?" I said, "You're joking." Graham had rung up, and of course David hadn't been able to answer the phone, so he'd heard this message of himself coming back at him, and apparently he played me the message that Graham had left on the back of this, which was, "Get this f***ing thing off your phone."
I think probably the biggest irony of all, when you look back at Graham, particularly his England experience, was the fact that of all the managers I worked with, England managers, he was the most helpful from a media point of view. And yet he got it, you know, in the neck more than any of the others. And in fact, in many ways, he was probably over helpful. He used to, a bit like Cluffy, because he was the son of a journalist, Graham, you know, so he knew a little bit about the business. And sometimes he used to over-prepare little one-liners and stuff for press conferences, which then came rebound against him. Mm. And that's probably why he did that TV documentary, you know, because he loved the business, he loved the media.
And I think he probably assumed that England would qualify, but it would still nevertheless show up the difficulties of the job. But of course, Poland and Norway happened, and next thing you know, and then Koeman, of course, and this, if you haven't seen the documentary, it was recently re-shown on Channel 4, but they bleeped out a lot of the swear words, which oddly kind of diluted it a bit too much for me. If you can find it, it's on YouTube in various parts, and it's a proper snapshot of early 90s football, the way it's reported, the way it's perceived, the way the players are being perceived as they transform from being canon first division players into Premier League players and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember being when we played the famous game against San Marino, at the end of it, I mean, I had to record various pieces for, you know, use in news bulletins and overnight for breakfast shows and that kind of thing. And I remember sort of delivering this sort of Taylor's got to go thing, which you had to do, really, because you knew his number was up, failure to qualify. But I actually remember sort of feeling this intense sort of sadness in delivering those words, really, because, you know, he'd meant so much to me for so much of my life. You know, and I loved him. As Mike says, he was brilliant as England manager, wasn't he? He was fantastic to work with, a lovely guy, genuinely just the nicest person. And it was so sad that it, you know, in what should have been his greatest hour, it all just dissolved for him. And as Mike says, you know, he struggled to come to terms with it. But, you know, he'll always be a hero for me. And
yeah, I mean, I guess when it comes to looking at Graham, you have to put two hats on, really. You put your friendship hat on, but that mustn't obscure the fact that you then have to deal with it professionally, as I had to at the time as a correspondent. I had to deal with it. Yeah. And I guess looking back, you know, and he probably would accept that where it went wrong was that because he wanted to do it his way. He got rid of people like Don Howe, you know, who would have been a great ally to have had alongside, you know, continuity as well from Bobby Robson. And also because he perhaps had this, not insecurity, inferiority complex, but he felt probably because he hadn't played at any great level like Bobby Robson had, you know, and then like Glenn Hoddle and Terry Venables, he moved too quickly away from people like Chris Waddle, you know, and Brian Robson and people like that from 1990. And he went in with players who were just not as good, basically, you know, nothing like as good.
And that 1994 documentary kind of sums it all up. I remember the day that the news came out that he passed away. I was a game at Chelsea and my car was parked at the Shepherd's Bush shopping centre. And so was Nigel Adderley. He'd done the same thing, our colleague, and the tubes were shut. There was a problem with the tubes and it was bucketing down with rain, and Nigel and I elected to walk from Stamford Bridge all the way up to the shopping centre at Shepherd's Bush. And all that way, we didn't know that it was lashing it down with rain because we were just talking about Graham and swapping lovely stories about the man. And it made the torrential, sleeting, horrible rain, it just made it a complete irrelevance because it was one of the nicest conversations I've ever had about a man who I only got to know vaguely compared to you guys. But just a lovely man. And you talk about the, Mike, you talk about the pressures of post-England, and you're right, because he went to Wolves and it didn't quite work for him at Wolves. And I do remember, I don't know why this story sticks with me, but a Wolves fan spat at him at one game when things were going particularly badly. And you'd have to have a heart of stone not to have felt for the man in that instance.
Well, I was fortunate to get an invitation to the funeral in Watford, Graham's funeral. And what was interesting, two things about that day. The service concentrated completely, really, on his abilities as a manager, as a club manager, which had kind of got obscured slightly by the fact that he became England manager. Yeah. You know, but there was a lot of talk about his days as a very, particularly in Watford, obviously. Yeah. The other thing I remember was that it was, again, absolutely chucking it down with rain. It was a horrible, horrible day. And I remember arriving at the church, right in the centre of Watford, the church, and I saw Martin Tyler outside, absolutely plastered in rain, you know. Mm. And I made my way to go in. And I said, are you coming in, Martin? Let's go in together. He said, no, I haven't had an invitation, but I just wanted to be here to pay my respects. Yeah. He was standing outside in the rain with all the Watford fans, just because he wanted to honour a football man.
Yeah, much missed. Really sadly missed man, Graham Taylor. Let me move on back to you, Ando, for a moment, because in the 1990s, you were working a lot for IRN, is that right? Independent Radio.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Independent Radio News was basically the agency that covered national and international news and sports and entertainment stories for the whole of the network. So, you know, BRMB in Birmingham, and obviously they had a very competent and quite large news operation. But obviously, you know, if it was anything outside the local area, we would provide all the stuff. So yeah, I was gallivanting around doing all kinds of stuff. It was fantastic, really.
You were witness to this 1990s change in the broadcasting landscape that I've talked about before on this show, where BBC local radio and independent local radio were like battling for the hearts and minds of listeners on a Saturday afternoon. Your job with IRN was slightly different, as you mentioned, but you'd have been party to all of that.
Yeah, I mean, just to use an example, I mean, if you're a station, say for example in Leeds or wherever it is, and you're covering Leeds United and local football, but you're doing a Saturday afternoon programme, I would be the reporter at sort of Manchester United against Arsenal, whatever it was, and we'd be doing updates into those programmes. But I mean, you know, I find it quite sad now that, you know, independent radio doesn't there's hardly any apart from, you know, the talk sport, but I'm talking about at local level, there's very little sports coverage these days. It's all changed. But in those days, it was great grounding. I mean, you know, there was rivalry, but Michael will agree with this. I'm sure it was always friendly. I never remember having any problem with, you know, the idea of the BBC and independent radio stations competing for listeners. I mean, when I was at Signal Radio, for example, the two stations were pretty different. I mean, Radio Stoke was the established station that had been there a long time. And Signal Radio was the new kid on the block. When I joined, it had only been going for 18 months. So we set up a sports show, and we consciously tried to make it very different from theirs. You know,
did you bid for rights as well, Ando? Did you get into that side of things?
No, I mean, neither of us did commentaries in those days. We did, as I mentioned, that cup game. That was the one game that we did because we bought the rights one off. I think only the bigger stations did commentaries in those days, the Radio Cities and the Metros and the BRMBs. You know, as far as we were, I mean, we used to still play music in the sports show, but we'd have this thing where we'd be halfway through the new Madonna single and we had a jingle and it went, "It's a goal!" And then we'd go over, "Let's go to the Victoria Ground now and join our reporter, George Andrews, who's going to tell us about a goal at Stoke against Rotherham," you know, or you'd they'd hit a jingle and it would go, "Oh no!"
It's good of Madonna to record that length for you.
Fair play to her. Yeah, she didn't charge much. She was very reasonable. Yeah, fair play to her. Always had respect.
Any a song you wish you could have butchered so that you could have "It's a Goal" over the top.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, that was the way it was. It was great fun. I mean, it was, as you say. It was fantastic for learning how to do stuff and how to, you know, I didn't become a commentator properly as a career until 2004, really, when I took redundancy from Independent Radio News and was lucky enough to get in at Sky. So, you know, I hadn't done an awful lot of commentary, but, you know, I think that the sort of spontaneity of those situations was quite helpful. I mean, you know, I'm not a particularly shy person when it comes to sort of spouting. But, you know, it is a strange kind of skill and technique, isn't it? And I just think that the sort of the off-the-cuff nature of doing that kind of broadcasting, I think, helps when you're describing football matches or indeed, you know, athletics events or whatever it is.
Mike, with you, with the journey that you've taken through broadcasting, it's taken through a lot of technological advances. You know, I know engineers take care of a lot of it, but we've moved through from telephone commentaries through to, you know, ISDN, the way we've used it now. You've seen the whole gamut of the way that this industry has, you know, become a much more polished enterprise, shall we say.
Yeah, just one little story, though, first about that. I mean, when I was at Radio Derby and I used to present the programmes on Saturday afternoon, right, and talking about these, using the local people to do your reports for you, because I was laughing when John was talking then. To save money occasionally, our guy who did Derby County coverage was the news editor. So sometimes just to save money, he'd stay at home. So we get a local guy. Now, they used to have, they've called them stringers, didn't they, these guys, you know. And some of them would be covering about a game for six different radio stations. So they had no idea who they were talking to most of the time. You know, phone would ring and they'd go on and they... And I remember, and I'll have to make up the name of the team. I think it might have been Brighton. I can't remember. But I commissioned this guy to report on Brighton against Derby County, right? And he was obviously a big Brighton fan. So 10 minutes in, you know, so let's go over to the Goldstone Ground and whoever it was. And he came on with, "Wonderful news here. Brighton have just taken the lead." You know, I'm thinking, hang on a minute, you know. I didn't say anything. I just, okay, let it go now, you know. And then 15 minutes later, "You wouldn't believe it, but this is even better news now." You know. On half time and say, "Just so that you know, this is Radio Derby. County fans listening to you are not very appreciative." But yeah, I mean, so that was on the phone. Obviously, nowadays it would be, you know, studio quality. Yeah. It almost became too perfect at times, especially when you're abroad. I remember going to do a game in China, in Beijing, England friendly before Euro 96, and
That was a hell of a trip, Mike.
Yeah, and I remember the Chinese wouldn't let us use the commentary box unless
That's right.
we gave them another $10,000 in cash on the spot, you know, which clearly we, you know, we'd only got, you know, just to, I hadn't got the money anyway, so we couldn't get in there. Graham Kelly tried to get the door open for us, but he couldn't manage it. So we ended up doing the game on the phone, the whole 90 minutes on the phone. And we got loads of people ringing in and writing in and saying, "This is great. This is just like the old days, you know. Good. It sounds like you're in China and everything else, you know." Because sometimes when you pop up from these places, and it just sounds like you're next door, doesn't it? Because it's just a superb quality. But you're right. I mean, there were a hell of a lot. Well, I wouldn't know where to start with the technological advances, because the whole landscape of broadcasting changed from the 80s through to when I left.
I'll tell you another story, Mike, about, you know, using stringers. Quite often they would be people who weren't really broadcasters. They'd be the guy from the local newspaper. And if you were doing a game in, for example, somewhere like Torquay, you wouldn't go down to cover Port Vale or whatever it was for Signal Radio. So we'd use them. And I swear one of them actually, we said, "There's been a goal at Plainmoor, Port Vale in action tonight. Let's get the details of that goal from whatever his name was." And he actually said, "The goal has been scored by Phil Sproson." That's caps Sproson.
Brilliant.
And he just thought he was dictating copy.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Fantastic. Well, it was the famous, wasn't it the famous Bobcast story when he was working for a local radio? Was it Bobcast? And they rang him up and put him on air and said, and didn't realize it was on air, and said, "Hi, can you hear us all right? Yeah, just to make sure we can hear you, can you say something?" This was live on air. He says, "Yeah, it's fucking pissing you down there."
Tony Millard did the same, I think, for BBC Radio Kent. I think he was doing a game down at Brighton, and there's a very softly spoken man in the studios in Maidstone saying, "Tony Millard's down at the Goulston Grand for his Tony." And he puts the fader up, and you can hear the crowd noise, but you can't hear Tony. Oh, and Tony's not there. And then suddenly you just hear this, "Open the fader." This poor softly spoken chap, without the aid of a dump button, somehow has to well, the dump button saved many a football phone in, since it was Tony Butler in BR&B
the famous one.
that necessitated the invention of the 7 second delay.
Was that the A's for soft tone? Is that the one?
That's it. Tony Trathewey, when John Osborne was meant to be coming for an interview after Albion had won promotion. "Hello, Tone. Tony's pissed off, Tone."
Oh, is it?
Which became a Jasper Carrot stand-up routine that he managed to eke out a good 10 minutes of live material from.
The biggest thing that changed, actually, probably once the Premier League came, it was were the commentary positions for us. We were very lucky on Radio 2 in the days of Peter Jones and Brian Butler. We used to have, you know, front row of the director's box. I mean, and then gradually, as the Premier League kicked in and the corporates took the commentary positions, basically, we'd end up over the corner flag in some places, you know. So that was one thing that definitely that did change. Actually, Wembley too was a classic example. The old Wembley, we had a wonderful position. It was the old Greyhound box right at the top, you know, looking down over the halfway line.
Wow.
And then when the new Wembley came along, I never liked commentating at the new Wembley. We were we were behind glass, behind all the corporate people moving around and everything else. If it was an early game on a Saturday afternoon, the sun would be streaming in. You couldn't see the numbers on the shirts or anything. So I you know, I don't miss that, I have to say.
No, do you know any altercations with supporters in these areas? But I mean, I've had run-ins with fan. I mean, I've had one at Millwall that I've spoken about before, and a fan at Derby who tried to throw a punch at me for having the temerity to call a Walsall penalty. It can be a precarious lifestyle, can't it, Ando?
Well, so funny you mentioned Derby. The only time that's happened to me was at Pride Park, and I didn't actually do anything. What I was doing my final report on the game, which I think Derby had lost 3-2, and without warning, this hand came across and knocked all my notes up in the air. And luckily, it didn't hit me. And I just thought, "What the hell are you doing?" I mean, it wasn't as if I'd said, Derby were an embarrassing disgrace. I mean, it was a straight match report. I mean, funnily enough, going back to what we were saying earlier about the sort of strange reactions that fans can have. One of the ones I remember, do you remember that trip to Albania, Mike, when England played? I know Andy Cole scored his first ever England goal. I think it was his only England goal. And because it was in Albania in those days, it's different now, but it was very extraordinarily primitive. There were no press facilities at all. And we ended up doing the post-match interviews in front of the team bus as the players got on. And just to my right was a barrier where there probably, a few hundred England fans had made the trip. And I said to Andy Cole, "Oh, Andy, can we do a quick piece about your goal, you know?" So he comes over, bless him. And just before I'm about to start, this fan said, "Andy, congratulations on your first goal for England." And Andy Cole went, "Oh, thanks very much." He said, "It makes up for all the others you bloody missed." I thought, oh, great. This is going to be a fantastic interview, this, isn't it? I mean, Andy Cole, you know, I mean, he's an okay guy. He wasn't the most media-friendly player anyway. And, of course, he'd got this fan, you know.
Well, sometimes a journalist would make it worse for us radio guys. When Trevor Francis was manager of Birmingham in the 90s, and it wasn't always playing sadly for Trevor, you know, a number of playoff semi-final defeats and everything. Worthington Cup final defeat.
Yes, can I just mention the one in 1999, Dan?
Yeah, go on. I was doing the PA announcing.
Alec Chamberlain.
Alec Chamberlain with penalty saves.
Sorry.
I was able to say, "Keep off the pitch." That was all I was able to say down the microphone as the penalty shootout finished. But
sorry, I just I had to.
No, no. But
you don't often, as a Watford fan, get a chance to gloat.
That's very true. And it was a horrible night. but Trevor used to come up to talk to me at the broadcast point once he'd done his written press conference. And for some reason, he took a dislike to Hugh Southam, the News of the World reporter who worked that patch. Yeah. And so I would stand at the back of this press room waiting for the written press, and then I would escort Trevor up to the commentary box. And it must have happened half a dozen times where Hugh is also at the back of the room. Trevor comes in, settles himself at his chair, and Hugh is the first voice to break the silence, going, "Now the disappointing performance today, Trevor." And Trevor's arms would fold on his sports jacket. "Well, I think you'll find." And you know, and suddenly he's on the defensive. And I think, oh, Jesus. I've got to talk to him after this. He's going to be in a foul mood by the time he's finished with this written presser.
John just mentioned Albania. And I guess that was one of the great things about my time working in that it took you to places that otherwise you'd never go to.
Yeah,
you'd never go to Albania on holiday, obviously.
No.
I remember, I think it was the first time we went. And it was a long trip. And we decided... with nothing to do, we went to see the under-21 game. I think it was the day before. And it was across country as well. It was like a 3-hour, 4-hour journey in this van, you know, across country. So we saw a lot of the countryside of Albania. And when we got there, all the press boys filed off the bus. And for some reason, Eric, do you remember Eric Brown from the press?
Yeah.
We got stuck at the back of this bus. And we got off late, so we got split up from the rest of the party who'd gone in. And a couple of security people, we just said to them, "England, England." "Oh, England, England, yeah, follow me, follow me, follow me." Anyway, they thought we were England, basically. They thought we were, you know. So they took us to the Royal Box in this stadium, sat us in the two VIP positions, reserved for Bert Milicic and Ted Brokaw, you know. Eric and I sitting there, you know, on the half, next to all these Albanian dignitaries. Meanwhile, Bert Milicic was kind of cowering in the corner somewhere, looking at us, you know, thinking, "What the hell are you doing there?" You know.
the other story there, we mentioned John Curtis earlier. Again, lovely man, big music fan. He was
It's one of my favourite. I think you're going to tell one of my favourite stories.
I mean, the famous story was it the I forget which world was it? 2002 World Cup when England beat Argentina
in Sapporo,
and in the bowels of the stadium near where the team coaches were. Where they were doing interviews and stuff, and John Curtis got slightly confused, and he walked onto this coach and sat down, thinking it was the coach that the travel company had hired to move the England media back to our hotel. And he thought, he's sitting there thinking, where's everyone else? And he looks around, and there's a guy next to him jabbing him, and it's Gabriel Batistuta. He's got onto the Argentina team bus instead of the England media bus.
JC had he would turn up at press conferences, and he, as you say, big music fan.
Yeah.
And we got onto, I don't know why, but he had this idea, non sequiturs was the thing with JC.
Yeah. Yeah.
Suddenly, Freddie Mercury would come up in conversation, and he'd start singing "Space Station Number 5" by Montrose. So, what are you doing, Joe? Why?
But there was a footballer called John Curtis. I can't remember. Oh, yeah. He played at Barnsley.
And
Man United. And I remember JC telling the story against himself. He went to interview him at the end of the game. Do you remember this story, John?
And he said, I remember a story involving the two. The one I know involves his Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I think. But go on.
Oh, yeah. When he went up to John Curtis, I think, and said, hi, John. John Curtis, same name. And the other John Curtis said, yeah, same name, different shape.
Different shape. Yeah, that's the one.
But things seem to follow JC around. Actually, things seem to follow you around, Ando, you know. Things happen to you that happen to nobody else on the planet. If people read your terrific book, A Great Face for Radio, which is still available from all good...
It's actually not. You can only get it from me now.
That's fine.
The only way you can get hold of a copy probably would be to send me a tweet at Great Face Radio and I can sort one out for you.
There you go.
But anyway, go on.
But things like, you know... Atlanta Olympics and bomb threats and you being in the centre of it all and something about a high-speed chase through the streets of Johannesburg. A brothel.
Well, I mean, that story was basically, we were covering the 1995 Rugby World Cup and I think I know why you've asked about this one because it involves your big mate and mine, Jim Proudfoot. We were in Johannesburg and we heard about some kind of club out of town that you could go to that was supposed to be really good. So we went out there and it was okay. It was nothing special, to be perfectly honest. But, you know, we were there for a while. And then when we got outside, there were absolutely no taxis. It was pitch dark in the middle of nowhere. So we never clue what we were doing. And we were desperately trying. And in those days, you couldn't phone an Uber. You know, we're talking about 1995. Mm. So basically what we did, we were sort of standing around. And these guys, local guys, said, we'll give you a lift back, no problem. So they drove us and they were speeding down the motorway with another guy alongside them. They were both. And the guy in the other car produced a gun and started firing it in the air through the window. And Jim and I are thinking, oh my God, what is going to happen here? Anyway, so they took us not to our hotel. They took us to this really weird looking concrete building in the middle of God knows where. And we said, where are we? And they said, oh, we're in Hillbrow. Now, before I'd gone to South Africa, I'd been told, avoid Hillbrow. It's the most dangerous place in the world. You don't want to go there after dark. And they said, come in with us for a drink. So we thought, well, what are we going to do, you know? So we came in for a drink and we were taken into this brothel. That's all I can describe. There's women draped around. And we had a couple of bottles of beer. And Jim, who was young, he's younger than I am. He was quite young at the time, I think. He's probably in his early 20s. I remember him just saying, get me out of here. And I'm thinking, what the hell are we going to do? But, you know, it's just one of those weird things. The guy just said, OK, guys, lovely to see you. Thanks for the drink. We'll take you home now. And they just drove us back to his... But Mike said it. I mean, the places you visit, it's ridiculous. Azerbaijan, Moldova, Albania, you know, Montenegro, all these places that, you know, so they're not necessarily on the holiday route. But, I mean, that was what my book was about, really. It wasn't really about... covering football as such, it was what happens in and around it, the things that go wrong. You know, the Atlanta Olympics, for example. I was in a bar with Steve Wilson, who's now obviously a doyen of Match of the Day commentaries. He was working for Capital Gold at the time, and you know, Irish guy at the back of the bar got a phone call and said there's a bomb gone off, and we just ran down to the park where it had happened. And you know, we got some amazing audio and some extraordinary interviews. And, you know, it's just riding your luck, isn't it? I mean, you know, we could have been fast asleep. Actually, it was quite funny because we were with Dave Clark, who was Steve's colleague, and another colleague of mine, Guy Swindles, who obviously you know. Apparently, what happened was Steve and I spent the whole night basically filing stories about this bomb, interviews, etc., and eventually got into bed at about 5 a.m. or something. And Steve was woken up about an hour later by Clarkey, who was going off to do the rowing, Steve Redgrave. And he banged on the door. Steve! Steve! And Steve opened the door and said, "What? What the hell?" He said, "There's been a bomb." He says, "I know, I've just spent 5 hours finally on it." Clarkey didn't realise this.
Oh, no. I'm not sure how many close shaves you might have encountered, Mike, in your journeys around the globe. I don't know whether you're slightly more protected than Ando was from the trials and tribulations of covering sport.
I guess the two occasions that most of all brought me shudderingly back down to earth, different sort of experiences. At the end of my first season commentating, I was rewarded with the European Cup final at the Heysel Stadium. Without going into all of the details again, you know, found myself there with Peter Jones and Emlyn Hughes, just the three of us, no producer or anything like that. Yeah. Having to witness the scenes, and because Peter had to stay in situ commentating, I had to go downstairs and just basically confirm that people had died and just be looking at dead bodies for the first time in my life, you know, and that was just harrowing. And then the other one, I suppose, was one I think about a lot, was going to do an Arsenal game in Europe against Real Mallorca on the day of 9/11, and sitting in a bar with the other press boys, just watching all the events unfold in New York, and then in a surreal way having to go to the game and commentate on the game of football that evening, you know, which really should have been called off.
Yeah.
And then later in the day having to get onto an aeroplane to fly back to England with the Arsenal squad, you know, that was, and I remember the first thing I did when I got into the house at about 5 o'clock in the morning was just go upstairs and give my two little boys a cuddle, you know, because it made me think how vulnerable we all are, really, you know, and how tenuous life is, really.
It is all very fleeting sometimes. So you do cherish the good times when they come along. And you're both right. You know, you go to places that you would never go on holiday to. And I do cherish a day or two that you, Mike, and I spent in Belo Horizonte just before England's final group game in Brazil 2014, when the die was already cast and we knew that England were going home. I was as well. You weren't. You were staying out. as Ando once told me, that's the great thing about being the England correspondent. You're never in it for the long haul.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, no. I mean, I used to have two different experiences, though, going to tournaments. You know, I used to go out there with England, but not for very long. And then suddenly, halfway through, I'd have to then start watching teams, you know, the regular games without having seen any of them play before, you know. But covering England was... Oh, it was amazing, wasn't it? I mean, the amount of talk beforehand, John. You know, they'd always have the best training camp, the best hotel. And there was a ritual of the first week of everyone, you know, singing from the same sheet, great spirit in the camp, and all that crap, you know, basically. And then the game would kick off the first game, and they couldn't keep the ball, you know, the rest was history. And then invariably, it's why I call my book After Extra Time and Penalties, they would go out on penalties, which used to do my head in, because I'm thinking, I can see other countries learning from, like Italy, for example, missing penalties, but never learning from it. Yeah. And so you can imagine how I felt, can't you, my first World Cup, not covering, you know, as in retirement, watching the World Cup in Russia with my boys on the settee.
Yeah.
Up comes the penalty shootout, and I'm thinking, oh, here we go again. And they only won it, bloody well go and win it, you know. It's, you know, they've obviously been waiting for me to quit, and now the show has had to take. Although, having said that, of course, since then we've had the Euros, which was the same old story again, wasn't it? Yeah. You know,
I mean, one of the things I remember, Mark, I can vividly remember you and me walking across the tarmac somewhere, probably at Luton Airport or somewhere, on the eve of a big tournament, and everyone's, as you say, is full of enthusiasm and optimism. But I do remember you saying to me, you said, the thing is, we always go into these tournaments with huge confidence, huge optimism and huge belief, but we're always I remember you saying that. This is a wonderfully prosaic way of putting it, and completely accurate as well.
But the friendships that you forge when you when you work with press packs, and you know, I was in Brazil working with a press pack. I was often the sort of class clown, just doing impressions on the coach when we were driving to Sao Paulo and things like that. So you know, you forge these friendships, you know, because people enjoy your company. But speaking of Belo Horizonte, I knew I was going home, so I was quite deflated knowing that I'd be heading back home. I'd had no further use for TalkSport after England had exited. But we went out for a meal. Mike may well remember this, but we went out for a meal, Mike and myself, and Phil McNulty, the chief sports writer of the BBC, and I think Danny Mills was there, and a few others. And we just went to this steak restaurant, steakhouse, somewhere in Belo Horizonte, Mike, and we had the most... a dinner that I will cherish for the rest of my life, because it was just... I laughed all night. And I when I walked in there, I wasn't really ready to laugh because I was a bit despondent about going home. But nights like that, when you're working, when you're just having dinner with people that you respect and you love, it makes it all worthwhile somehow.
Yeah, and I think that particular night, we got one or two people to tell their favourite stories. And it was all recorded, by the way. I don't know if you know this. And I've still got the tape. Our engineer recorded everything, and I've still got it. It's hilarious, honestly. Even looking back, and Ian Dennis tells this amazing. I can't repeat it now, but unbelievable joke. You know.
Any of it.
That was the thing, though. I mean, the players, the squad, used to think that the press were against them. Some of the press, but of course, you know, the press wanted England to stay out there as long as possible. They didn't want to be home after 2 weeks. You know, it was a fallacy.
I remember you turning up in at Sandton in Johannesburg, Ando, because you were the England correspondent at the World Cup in 2010 for TalkSport. You came back to our lodge. You were just kicking a ball around for 2 days because England were done. Your flight was a couple of days. So you had literally nothing to do for two days.
I had a week. But luckily I've got a big mate, a guy called David O'Sullivan, who's he's a radio presenter in Johannesburg, and he was whizzing me around, taking me to all these amazing pubs. You mentioned kicking the ball around. It's one of my proudest moments, actually, ever. I mean, I was not a particularly great footballer, pub level, not much more. And I was, remember Ray Parler was with us, and we were kicking the ball around, and Ray Parler said, "Oh, you've got quite a nice touch." And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, Ray Parler thinks I've got a nice... Those were great accolades I've ever had, certainly in my footballing career. So that was good fun, though, wasn't it? We had some good nights out.
I can guarantee you, Ando, that Ray Parler never meant a word of that. He did exactly the same thing to Moose, Ian Abraham.
Oh, my God, no. Well, I've seen him play, and he can't...
Well, yeah, but he said the same thing to... Because it's a similar thing in that garden area and that lodge.
Yeah.
Kicking the ball around, and Ray's gone, "Yeah, you're Moose, you got good touch, you're quite a good player. Did you ever have a trial?" Anyway, and the next morning at 7 o'clock, there's a knock on Ray Parler's door. He opens it, and there's Moose with a ball. He wants to go and have a kick. He's created a monster. Ray's unwitting. Yeah, no. He created a...
Wow. You've completely ruined my day by saying that. Thank you very much.
I can remember Chris Waddle, who was wonderful company, wonderful travelling companion. Sometimes when we, especially in Japan, to kill some time during the day, we just go off on his own, wander around looking for kids playing football in the park, you know, and ask if he could join in. And they had no idea who he was, you know. And I remember somebody went with him once, I can't remember who it was now, and these kids, they were about 7 or 8 Japanese boys, you know, and Chris was sort of giving emotionally, give us the ball, you know. And one of them kind of lobbed the ball up, and it was quite an awkward ball to control, and he kind of brought it down on his net, you know, and flicked it up and headed it. And these kids were going, "Whoa!" You know, they couldn't believe it.
Well, we used to have the England Media 11 as well. I used to occasionally play for them.
I was never invited. What was that?
I played in a few. I mean, I wasn't great, but it was good fun. In Euro 92, we lost 8-0 to France. But one of the main reasons was that the French midfield player was one Jean Tigana, who was slightly better than an assembled group of overweight hacks from England. It's not fair.
And Giresse played in the game too. It was Giresse and Tigana.
They both played.
And I don't know if it was that game or the Sweden game, because England's press team always played the teams that were going to play
in the senior.
Famous story of the press team always had two or three, you know, celebs playing for them. Famous story of Bobby Charlton, remember? And Rob Shepherd, who was playing centre forward, you know, Charlton crosses the ball to him, and Rob Shepherd turns around to one of the great Bobby Charlton and says, "Charlton, I want the ball to my feet."
Yeah, Trevor Brooking used to turn out, didn't he?
Yeah.
And another late lamented friend, Ray Clements, I remember playing. I remember Ray Clements. We played a game in Sweden, not during that tournament, but it was a game we were playing against. I think it was the one where Terry Butcher's got the injury and was covered in blood. And we were 3-2. I actually scored in that game. I was quite pleased with that. But we were 3-2 up with about a minute to go, and we got a penalty, and Ray Clements, who was playing at left back and was obviously he was a good player as well as a goalkeeper, he took the penalty and he blasted it so far over the crossbar that it disappeared into the horizon, and people looked round and went blimey, and he just said, "Don't worry, lads, waste a bit more time, we'll be quicker to the beers," and the referee then blew his whistle.
it's great stuff. Mike, we do miss you. In the press box, I think it goes without saying.
Thank you.
But 28 FA Cup finals. I think I'm right in saying that you covered for the BBC. Is there one that particularly sticks out as being the ultimate, the one that you enjoyed most, or the one that sticks with you?
Cup final, I remember most of all. It was actually the one I was taken to by my dad, first of all, the West Ham Preston game, when I was just a kid, just a teenager. That's the day I'll always remember going to Wembley.
Right.
In terms of working, I always used to associate Peter Jones, my colleague, with the FA. So it was never an FA Cup final that I attended where I wasn't thinking about Peter on the day, because I know that there was a day that we, in fact, Peter now would hate the fact that the FA Cup has been diminished. It has. No matter what people say, the FA Cup is not the FA Cup that it was 20, 30 years ago. Mm. In terms of my favourite would probably be the one in Cardiff between Liverpool and West Ham. That would be the one that I would remember most of all. The sheer drama of Gerrard's late equaliser, 3-3 and then penalties. Penalties again, after extra time and penalties. But that, funnily enough, I think the cup finals in Cardiff, I can't really generalise, but many of them were better than the ones that we've seen more recently at Wembley. I don't know why it should be.
The first one back at Wembley was a terrible...
Chelsea, Manchester United, yeah. I used to love Carl going to Cardiff. We had a fantastic commentary position there. And I love the way that the stadium's right in the city centre and everything else. I love the vibe, the buzz around the game and everything, which you never got at Wembley at all. That was... The FA Cup final was always... very, very special to me. I just wish it was as special nowadays. Unfortunately, I know it's not.
So, Ando, these days, you are working a lot for the TalkSport International Service, which is subsidiary to what we do in the UK. This is radio commentaries that go around the world, right?
Yeah, no, it's great. I love doing it. I mean, I would freely admit that being the sort of person I am, I do find radio commentary more easier and more enjoyable than doing television comedy. I mean, I like doing television comedy, and I'm lucky enough, I do games for BT Sport, which is fantastic. But I find the whole thing of television a bit more daunting. There's people in your ears all the time, there's producers, and you're trying to react to things that are in vision. You have to do promos during the game. Don't forget to join us next Saturday for Brighton against Wolves or whatever it is. But the international stuff is fantastic. I mean, for those that don't know, TalkSport has the right to broadcast radio commentary to the rest of the world, really, outside Europe. And I think there's a station in Ireland that takes it as well. And it's enormously gratifying, because what we do is, we open it up to Twitter and say, they can talk to us via Twitter during the commentary. And, it's very, very popular in places like Nigeria and Ghana and Uganda. I mean, there's also a sizable listenership in the United States, which is great because the game is picking up there quite quickly, Australia and various others. And, it's lovely to think that, you're bringing the Premier League to people who, don't necessarily or haven't necessarily previously had the opportunity. I mean, some of the tweets we get, I mean, some of them are hilarious. Some of them tell us what they're having for dinner or where they are or what bar they're in. But, I had one from, there's a lad in Port Harcourt in Nigeria who now wants to be a commentator because he likes my commentary, which is incredibly gratifying. We had another tweet, which is a village in Uganda where apparently they don't have a television set. So on Saturday, the whole village gathers round the radio and listens to, and it's incredibly empowering. And I've had students saying, we love your, not me necessarily, but all of the lads, we love your commentaries because it broadens our vocabulary of English. And what the another thing I like about it is, you know, with television, you know, you, obviously everything's in front of you, whereas radio, and particularly radio to an audience which is foreign, I mean, I don't suppose half of them know where Burnley is, you know, so you can spend ages describing the town of Burnley, talking about the history of the club, describing Turf Moor and the hills in the background, and sometimes there's a bit of snow, and I love all that. It's okay. Painting pictures, and you know, I absolutely love doing it. It's great fun. I mean, yes, I've been lucky. I've worked for the bits and pieces for the BBC. I've worked for Sky. I obviously enjoyed working for TalkSport, the British version. But yeah, for me, I mean, you know, I'm 61 years old now, so it's kind of like a really nice way, nice gentle way to kind of, you know, maintain a profile and a career, but not having to do it, you know, too much gadding about. Yeah. It's nice that football is part of the lives of people. English football is part of the lives of people in far-flung places. And, you know, it's hugely enjoyable. I love doing it. Yeah, it's great.
And so, Mike, what are you up to these days, apart from augmenting your vinyl collection, I imagine, as much as possible?
Waiting for the lady to ring the bell at about 5:30 in my little Cornish town to say that the pasties are half price. No, I'm joking. I mean,
I wouldn't blame you. If that's the case.
I'm listening and watching all the football. Obviously, I miss the camaraderie of all the people that I used to be with. I'm glad that I never had to commentate on VAR, for example. I never experienced that. It makes me wonder how many goals I described in my career that actually would have been ruled out, you know. And it's taken a lot of the joy away from I would have hated to have commentated in empty stadiums as well. I don't know how the boys did that. I mean, the VAR thing's interesting. Obviously it would have been nice to have had VAR around for Maradona and for Frank Lampard too, you know, in Bloemfontein. That would have been useful, certainly. But I also think that one of the biggest bees I've got in my bonnet now, because I did write about this. Just on VAR again, I did experience VAR in a sense, because I think the first time it might have been used in a high profile way without people realizing it, and it was never admitted to, was when Zidane in the World Cup final. Do you remember? And there was enough time for them to go and look at the replay and everything else, because otherwise I don't think he'd have been sent off in that game. So that was another where they got it right.
Very true.
I'm still staggered in this multi-billion-pound industry that the amount of time played in the game is never 90 minutes, and it's so arbitrary. I don't understand why we can't take a leaf out of American sport and have a proper clock at games, and that clock stops every time the ball is not in play, basically. Because I reckon probably in any 90 minutes, you're probably only going to get about 65 minutes of actual action.
They used to have it as a graphic, Mike, on screen. When Sky did games, I'm sure they had a ball in play time in very tiny lettering. In the halftime stats analysis, and it would invariably say ball in play 30 minutes out of 45.
Well, when you think it takes a second to score a goal, and when you think about, you know, I sometimes watch the Jeff Stelling on a Saturday afternoon, and you see goals being scored 90 plus six, you know, and everything else, you realize how important time is. And it's not I'm not asking for anything particularly sophisticated, but I just think it's so arbitrary and it's too much for a fourth official to. And the other thing about it is that none of the spectators in the stadium, no one knows how much time there is to go. No. And the other thing that always creases me up as well is the fact that because it's so arbitrary, the referee will invariably allow a corner or a free kick to be taken before blowing the whistle. Yeah, well, I mean, if the time's up, the time's up.
Jack Taylor will blow the whistle whilst the corner's being taken.
Don't you think it's strange that we've been, you know, we're so paranoid about the VAR and stuff like that, and yet we're not guaranteeing that the game has 90 minutes football in it.
The other thing about VAR from a commentator's point of view, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, Dance, is that it what happens is, a goal goes in, you identify the scorer, you then say something about it being his eighth goal of the season, you know, it's put them 2-1 up, they've come from behind, blah, you go on and on and on. And then 3 minutes later, you're saying, Oh, no, sorry, that didn't happen. No, that was nonsense. Forget that. And then the next time the player scores, you have to repeat it all again. You think, well, you already know it's his eighth goal of the season because I told you it was when it wasn't.
Well, what happens is I have a video printer when I'm doing a commentary, because I'll be at Chelsea for Chelsea Leeds at the weekend. Yeah. And I have a little video printer that will update me with scores from elsewhere whilst I'm commentating. And, of course, what happens now, if a goal goes in the Premier League and it comes up, on my video printer, it doesn't then come up with a correction goal disallowed. That goal or that headline just disappears off my screen. So we've got this maxim, haven't we, on TalkSport, goals as they go in. Mm-hmm. I've now got to think goals as they're ruled out, because it seems that every week there's something that gets chalked up.
It does make you wonder how the whole history of the game might have changed, though. For example, the obvious one is Jeff Hurst, isn't it, at Wembley in 66, you know?
We could be here for another hour and a half debating goals that should have been and goals that weren't. Oh, crikey. Yeah. Gentlemen, we've chatted for about an hour and a half here, I think, maybe more, and we've barely scratched the surface. It's been fantastic company. I must alert listeners to both your books. Extra Time and Penalties is yours, Mike. And I'm not sure how reticent you were about releasing it or putting it out there for the public to enjoy at first.
I didn't have a publisher for it. So basically, my book was in two bits. I borrowed a hardback, which I think you've got. And that was just for family and friends and colleagues. And it was not for sale. And so I had a bit more license with some of the language in it, you know. Yeah. And then I did put out a paperback version, which came out three or four months later. I enjoyed doing it. It was good therapy.
We're only disappointed that you didn't take mine and Phil McNulty's and Ian Dennis's suggestion and you didn't call it Behind the Mic, because we thought that was an absolute given as a title.
It's too obvious. But
yes, Extra Time and Penalties is Mike's book, which you can obtain. And as Ando mentioned earlier, if you go to his Twitter feed at Great Face,
you'll have to send me a message. Basically, I've got a box of them upstairs. I mean, as Mike knows, you're never going to get rich writing a book. I mean, you know, you end up with the author only gets about 10% of the and the royalties diminish as time. And I wrote mine in 2009.
Same with songwriting, mate.
Yeah, well, exactly.
I mean, the main aim from my book really was to pay tribute to some of the people who never really get talked about, the Peter Jones of this world and Brian Butler and people like that. I'm going to just ask you a question before we leave, Ian. Because one I wanted to ask you many times. So you get this choice of commentating on Birmingham City winning the Premier League title or getting a Grammy for Album of the Year.
Oh, well, I guess because I was at Wembley in 2011 and I witnessed something that I never thought I would in terms of the League Cup win, I think that's a bit selfish, isn't it, to think the Grammys... it's got to be a Grammy. I was nominated for a radio award in 2004 and never succeeded. That's the closest I've ever come to winning anything in terms of any sort of accolade in my career. So I think the new album, when it comes out next year, if anybody can see their way to pushing it under the Grammy committee's nose, best rock album. I mean, if Jethro Tull can beat Metallica in 1980, whenever it was, for best metal album, then I'm sure. Oh yeah, that was a big controversy.
You'd never describe Tull as metal.
And Metallica, they actually shooed in. I forget which album it was. It might have been "And Justice for All" or "Master of Puppets." But
I'll get my wife to make a few phone calls for you.
Yeah, she's well connected. Dance, actually, Mike's wife is very well connected in these circles.
Well, now you're pushing an open door with me here, as the great Mike Dickin used to say. honestly, Mike, I would take the Grammy. I think that sounds dreadfully selfish, doesn't it? So maybe I'll maybe I'll end up retracting that if Birmingham get to the semi-finals this year. But I think if they get to the final, I'm somewhere down the list of commentators they would choose first to send.
But you wouldn't want to commentate on it, would you? I mean, I remember when Watford got to... Sorry to bring up 1999 again, but when we got to the final against Bolton, I said, I'm not doing it. I want to be at the Watford end. I don't want to be commentating on it. And it was a good decision because it was a fantastic day. And Nicky Wright scored his extraordinary overhead kick.
Yeah.
We won 2-0. We got promoted to the Premier League. And I would not have wanted to have done that behind the mic at all.
2011, I wasn't doing commentary that day for TalkSport because Sam Matavace and Stan Collymore were doing the game. But I was up on the gantry with them for sort of colour, Birmingham City angle. So, of course, when Lee Bowyer gets cleaned out by Chesney in the first 5 or 10 minutes, of course, they go to me apoplectic with rage that penalty not be given. Here we go again. The gypsy's curse is going to strike once again. And then, of course, what happened. And the fact that I had two production assistants sat next to me on the gantry, both Arsenal fans, and our then head of live sport, Matt Smith Villa, who was sat there.
Yeah.
And Birmingham fans, limbs all around them. And me actually losing the professional mask, slipping as it did at that moment. It was like being in the Blues end that day, I must say, Ando. So it's probably just as well I wasn't on the mic when Martin tapped it in. It could have been, they'd have needed about 10 7-second delays to cut out all the bad language. But it's lovely to speak to you both. It's great to be back in touch with you, Mike. And I wish you well for every pasty hunt that you have every day.
Yeah, and it's not, by the way, it's not a commentator's curse, it's a commentator's joy.
Very true. But that's that Muslim Pavlovian conditioning, that bell to go and get the pasty. Salivate, and you're straight there. Ando, what are you up to this weekend?
What am I doing? I am Man City Wolves, and then I'm doing a midweek game. I think it's West Ham Arsenal on the Wednesday. So, no, it's been an absolute pleasure, Dan. It's lovely, lovely. I mean, give us a text if you're in London. We'll have a pint, mate.
Oh, that'd be great.
Well, I can slag off your music taste, and you can slag off mine. It'll be a wonderful evening.
I think for the three of us, there is a Venn diagram where we.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what's in the middle. I think it's probably
early Genesis, maybe.
Maybe, yeah, or Led Zeppelin.
Shawaddy Waddy.
It's probably AC/DC might be one of them.
Yeah, I think that's fine. AC/DC, Zeppelin, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of stuff.
The Who, yeah, there you go. You see, there's more than you realise.
Yeah, I know.
It's just, you can have your fall, and I'll have the Kiss stuff and Rush and whatever. Gentlemen, thanks very much indeed. It's been a pleasure chatting to you on the Commentator's Curse. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Ando.
Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Take care.
So my thanks to John Anderson and Mike King and my guests on the Commentator's Curse for this episode. Brilliant stuff. Another episode on the way soon, and the archive is there for you to enjoy. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, I'd be very grateful for you to rate, review and subscribe in a positive fashion to what you've heard. And we'll see you next time. Ian Danter signing off. This has been the Commentator's Curse.